Thank you very much, and thank you, Findlay, for asking me to come along. I've written this paper. In fact, there are really two limbs to it. There's substantial injustice, and there's also loss of time directions, which I'm going to talk about, because as I see it, both of these things have become quite serious obstacles to people wishing to appeal to the Court of Appeal Criminal Division. Now, I'm not going to read my paper out in full. I'm just going to try and give you some of the highlights of it. I imagine it will be circulated later on. But I'll say this, that I'm feeling an unusually heavy onrush of imposter syndrome that most advocates feel when they go into the Court of Appeal, where they know that their argument is going to be unpicked by three extremely clever individuals. And now I'm in front of about 25 extremely clever individuals, so I expect every loose thread to be unpicked until the whole garment falls into a tangled heap on the floor. But nevertheless, we'll press on. The Court of Appeal's annual report of last year gives statistics that I think are really quite interesting, and I think support the idea that there aren't enough cases getting through. I'll tell you what I mean in a minute. The court, according to its report, received 1,417 applications for leave to appeal against convictions in the year preceding. I'm not dealing with sentence appeals, of which there are rather more. That's another topic. Of those, 260, that is about 18%, got past the filtering stage of the single judge and were heard by the full court. The full court allowed 94 of the appeals which it heard, 94 out of 260, giving about 36% of those heard a positive outcome. But only about 6.5% of the 1,417 cases resulted in convictions being quashed. Now, that strikes me as being a surprisingly small proportion of successful appeals. A small proportion not only of those that are made, not of applications that are made, but when you look at the enormous number, tens of thousands of convictions per year in the Crown Court, it's a minuscule number of cases that ever get to the point where convictions are being quashed. Now, I wonder why that is. Is it because everything else is absolutely tickety-boo, the other 93.5% is all perfect, or are other factors in play? Now, I don't have an answer to that. There may not be a readily available answer. And I'm not an academic. I'm a practitioner, and my chief concern when acting for the defence is knowing how to advise clients who've been convicted and who are contemplating making an appeal. And the two factors that I've indicated, the substantial injustice issue, which concerns, okay, a small amount of cases nevertheless, and the loss of time direction, seem to be symptomatic of, shall we say, a discouraging approach from the court towards appeals. And I look forward to hearing from Mrs. Justice Chima Grubb about whether I've got that completely wrong, or whether in fact there is an atmosphere that pervades that court which is to discourage people from appealing, and whether these two factors that I've identified represent that atmosphere. Now, if I'm right, if there is a sense in which appeals in general are to be discouraged, it means that viable appeals are not entering the system, and it means that people are in prison or have the stigma of criminal convictions who, at least arguably, ought not to have them. Now, I wonder, and again, this is more of a question than an answer, whether the resistance, if it exists, can be put down, at least in part, to treating the verdicts of juries almost as infallible. And it's right that the verdicts of juries should be respected on the basis that by the time the jury gets to reach its verdict, trials have been properly conducted, and if there have been egregious errors, they can be identified. So I've got no problem with the proposition that the jury's verdict should be accorded an enormous amount of respect. But should it be an article of faith? And should the infallibility of judges be regarded as an article of faith, such that where mistakes are recognised, they are often excused or mitigated or found to be, yes, there was a mistake made, it might have been quite a serious mistake, but we don't think it made any difference to the outcome of the case. So I think that the non-interventionism by that court can cause problems and can cause injustices to be missed. So I want to look just for a moment at these two specifics. The treatment of appeals that have arisen in change of law cases, and this whole thing got a new lease of life after the Supreme Court's decision in Jogi, which I expect you all know about, where the court decided that 32 years of doctrine of parasitical accessorial liability was wrong. Dr. Dyson was one of the great proponents of the proponents of how to correct the error, where the error had been made in the work that he did for the lead appellant in that case. So I defer hugely to his better understanding of the issues. But nevertheless, that was what happened. 32 years of law were said to be wrong because they'd mistaken the proper basis of secondary liability. It was not foresight, it should have been intention, and it's been corrected. But that case didn't invent, but I'd say it re-sanctified the older concept that where there'd been a change of law, to get into court, to get leave out of time in a historic case, the applicant has to show that he has suffered what the court calls a substantial injustice. That has become the test. Now, in my view, and if I was saying it to my lady in court, I'd say in my submission, that places an unfair burden on applicants for two reasons. Because the concept of a substantial injustice is poorly defined. In fact, it's barely defined at all. And secondly, because it appears to create a more stringent test than the test of showing this conviction is unsafe if you've got yourself into court. At least it's a different test. It's not clear to me why you need to have a different test to get into court in an old case where there's been a change of law from the test that you need to show that your appeal should succeed. So what is a substantial injustice? How much injustice is the Court of Appeal prepared to tolerate before it regards it as substantial? We don't know. You might say that it's almost a definition of substantial injustice for somebody to come to court and say, I was convicted 20 years ago because at that time the judges had got the law wrong and I should never have been convicted. Some people might say that in itself, standing alone, it is an injustice and a substantial one. Even if the applicant, the defendant, at the time got the right advice, according to the law as it then was understood to be. It turns out later that the law was misunderstood and the person should never have been convicted. So the concept itself is woolly. And how is it being interpreted? Well, there's a case called Ordu, which I'm going to talk about in a little more detail, from 2017, where the Court of Appeal thought it knew a substantial injustice when it saw one. Ordu was a refugee from Turkey. And in 2007, he pleaded guilty to an offence under the Identity Cards Act of having a false passport when he turned up in the UK claiming to be a refugee. And he pleaded guilty, got 9 months in prison for his offence. Many years later, it became clear that he had a defence all along because he was a refugee. And in 2016, he applied for leave to appeal out of time. Once he had been advised that he would have had a defence at the time that he pleaded guilty, the Crown, as respondents, gave what the law report describes as a strong indication that if the extension of time is granted, the appeal will not be opposed. So they saw the justice of his case. And on that footing, the court itself accepted that they would have allowed the appeal on its merits if they were willing to grant him leave out of time. But they said this, and I'm going to read out what they said. The quashing of the conviction, they said, would not make any practical difference to Mr. Ordu at all. He was released from his sentence in 2008 and the licence period expired in the same year. He has now been granted indefinite leave to remain in the UK and UK nationality. Apart from the stigma of having suffered conviction and the unpleasant experience of serving 4.5 months in a prison nearly 10 years ago, there are no continuing consequences of his conviction. Jog on, Mr. Ordu, they said. Now, does anyone here think that the stigma of having suffered conviction and the unpleasant experience of serving 4 months in a prison, especially for a refugee escaping persecution, are matters to be treated quite so lightly, or one might even say quite so dismissively? You might think that an innocent person would feel the stain of an unnecessary conviction forever and would resent the approach that the court took. This is the point, the court there had the opportunity to right a wrong that it recognised, but it wouldn't do it. And maybe it's naive to think that righting wrongs is what the Court of Appeal is for, but in that case, it failed. So let's hope that decision is simply an outlier and that the judges got out of bed the wrong side that day. Because the decision seems to be slightly at odds with what Lord Thomas said in a case called Johnson, which was, I think, the first major Court of Appeal decision following Jogi, dealing with a historic out-of-time case, which leave was refused. But he said it's not material to consider the length of time that has elapsed. If there was a substantial injustice, it's irrelevant whether that occurred a short time or a long time ago. But we're still no closer to understanding what substantial injustice really boils down to. And just as a sort of final word on that part of it, there's a case called Garwood from 2017 again, in which somebody who had been refused leave to appeal out of time for lack of substantial injustice thought that they might try the Supreme Court to appeal against the refusal decision by the single judge. They were denied leave and they were simply told, well, there's just no jurisdiction. to hear, for the Supreme Court to hear an appeal against the decision to refuse leave in the first instance. So that avenue is closed. Loss of time durations. Forgive me if practitioners know this, not everybody may know it. When the single judge reviews the grounds of appeal and the application in the first filtering stage, there's a box to tick, which is a box that's ticked on the form if the single judge thinks that the case is so lacking in merit that if it's pursued, then the applicant risks losing time off the sentence, the time between, or some part of it, between the date of the refusal and the date of the final disposal. That time effectively can be added on at the end of the sentence. Doesn't count. Now, it's a major deterrent to hopeless appeals. And it is, I'm sure Mr. Justice Chimbledrup will say, it is a vital tool to prevent pointless, vexatious, no hope appeals from clogging up the courts. One can see the point of that. But over the years, the court has made a number of decisions emphasising that where the box is not ticked by the single judge, there is no guarantee that the full court, if the application is renewed, will not discount the time that's been allowed. Even if counsel, and dare I say leading counsel, have advised that the appeal may have merit. There's a case from last year called Babiak, in which the court, and the tone of the judgment is very angry. You can really, it's sort of red hot on the page. You can read it and you can see it's an angry decision. The court decided in that case that the appeal was simply unmeritorious. They did not say totally without merit or wholly unmeritorious or should never have been brought. They just said this appeal is unmeritorious and we're going to tick the unticked box and we're going to order a loss of time direction. And they said these orders will continue to be made until it is eventually realised that unmeritorious applications wasting time of this court will not be tolerated, they said. But it seems to me that creates a different barrier to appeals, because I might think that my appeal has merit and I might advise my client that there are arguable grounds, and he might win. I can't say to him, it's guaranteed you're going to win. Now, how many of us have been in court when we've got a case that we think is not that great, and the judges really like it, and they uphold your submissions, and vice versa? I might think, I've got a great point here, and it's ripped to shreds within 5 minutes. So you never know. There's always the element of litigation risk. But that risk increases to a point where you find it very difficult to advise people, because how do I know that the judge is going to say this appeal's unmeritorious and you're going to get the box ticked? My client's going to say, well, I'm not taking that risk. I don't want to do another 5 or 6 months in jail, thank you very much, however good you think my case is. So I think that the substantial injustice test and the unpredictable nature of the loss of time duration are unnecessarily coercive measures that are used to deal with a problem, a genuine problem, which is the volume of work and probably the volume of really rubbish cases that the Court of Appeal has to deal with. But I think it's a blunt instrument, and it has the capability, at the very least, of deterring what may well be meritorious appeals, which should be allowed to succeed. If it's a matter of the court and the court staff being overwhelmed with more work than they can reasonably handle, then the issue is one of resources. And in my view, it should the difficulties that resource issues throw up should not be visited upon appellants who might have a reasonable case. Thank you. That's it.